He actually... he decided to send a fleet to reconquer Haiti. So they gained their freedom in 1803. Charles X, during the reaction in France, sends a fleet to reconquer them. At this point, they're just 2 weeks for another fight. So the Haitian government agrees to pay 150 million francs to France as reparations for losses related to the end of the slave trade. That's equivalent to $21 billion today. As a French abolitionist said, imposing an indemnity on the victorious slaves was equivalent to making them pay with money that which they had already paid with their blood. Other cases, you know, as a history teacher, I was like, man, are there other cases of the losers sending the bill to the victors? Yeah, in world history, it's mind-boggling, right? The French also demanded a 50% reduction in tariffs on all French ships docking in Haiti. And by comparison, the United States spent 80 million francs for the Louisiana Purchase, an area 74 times larger than Haiti. So we got to keep that in our mind. Now, things, it's cool though, right? In 1838, they make a treaty of friendship. The $150 million is reduced to 90 million francs. 30 annual payments of 2 million to pay off the balance, in addition to the payments made to private banks that Haiti had turned to in order to pay off the French. It reminds me of the Cooler X, the Malcolm X, quote, "You can't drive a knife into a man's back 9 inches, pull it out 6 inches, and call it progress." When they reduced by about 40% the debt owed to Haiti to France, they call it a treaty of friendship, as if they had done Haiti a favor. As late as 1915, 111 years after the successful slave revolt, 80% of Haitian government resources went to paying off loans from French and American banks that had been made to pay reparations to France. In 1915, the United States invaded Haiti for the first time, the first of three times in the 20th century. And after 7 years into the occupation, which cost approximately 11,000 to 15,000 Haitian lives, of course, America doesn't do body counts, the United States forced Haiti to take a $16 million loan from the federal government in order to pay off what they owed to France. They were able to pay off the loan to the United States in 1947, at which point the country was practically bankrupt. You go into the post-revolution era, under these sanctions, these embargoes, having to pay off these reparations to France for having the indignity of stealing their slaves from them, absolutely crippled the economy of Haiti. It wasn't able to develop in a normal route towards modernity or industrialism. It basically remained a peasant economy. Peasants in Haiti were forced to rely on subsistence farming. Now, the land reform that came after the revolution meant that many peasants, although they had to barely eke out an existence, did have reasonably large tracts of land. It had been devastated in the countryside, they'd lost many of the resources, but they were able to feed themselves. Then they had to bequeath their land to their children, and their children's children. In over a 150-year period, these plots of land that used to sustain the peasants became smaller and smaller and smaller, forcing them to get into things like deforestation, which we know played a huge role in the floods and hurricanes that have taken so many lives in Haiti over the recent years. And they would clear these forests for cooking fuel to supplement their income. The United States, continuing this predatory trend, supported Francois and the Jean-Claude Duvalier dictatorships from 1957 to 1986. These people robbed the country blind. They extracted the wealth without reinvesting. They failed to address the agricultural crisis. They accelerated deforestation. And in the 1970s, the Baby Doc Duvalier dictatorship implemented neoliberalism at the United States' urging, opening up the country to multinationals, creating these export zones. I think those of us from the West Coast and California are very familiar with the Maquila zones in Mexico. Basically, Haiti became one gigantic open-air sweatshop, a gigantic Maquila. In the 1980s, this is where the Haitian history starts to get really exciting. The masses rise up and the Lavalis movement, which I think is the coolest people's movement ever, because Lavalis in Creole means the flood. Like, can you imagine? The flood is coming. You know, that's just an amazing name. They drove Duvalier from power, and they elected a guy, a revolutionary priest named Jean-Bertrand Aristide, on a platform of land reform, aid to the peasants, reforestation, increase in wages, and union rights for sweatshop workers. And then there's a coup, which the United States backs in 1991, less than a year into Aristide's presidency, a year or two into his presidency. Clinton, in the presidential debates against Bush, the original, publicly opposed the coup in the debates, and once he gets into office, he dithers for 2.5 years, basically stringing Aristide along until Aristide agrees to a Faustian deal of dropping some of his early anti-capitalist sentiment and his early actions to improve the conditions of the Haitian people. Aristide once said, "I still think capitalism is a mortal sin." Mm. And yet he's forced to make this compromise with the United States with neoliberalism in order to come back to power, riding a wave of 15,000 U.S. troops sent to occupy Haiti. The United States, kindly enough, didn't lift the embargo, though, that they had imposed during the coup. So when RC comes back to power, the embargo continues, absolutely crippling what he's able to do. Fast forward, he's reelected again in 2001, and then you have the U.S.-backed coup in 2004. This group called the Group of 184, which is basically the Haitian bourgeoisie's organization, they back this coup, they throw the country into chaos, they're shades of Allende, they're shades of the coup against Chavez, they back the death squads that kidnapped and deported Aristide. We gotta remember, the people who were on the plane when Aristide in 2004 was flown to the Central African Republic were American soldiers. Kicked them off of the tarmac in the middle of a former French colony and flew back to the United States. From there, they orchestrated a UN occupation, which continues to this day, and they've installed a puppet government. And I'd like to say a lot more about Aristide, and I think there's a lot to be said about him. The man who wrote this book is an amazing Pan-Africanist activist named Randall Robinson, and he basically says that the reason that this coup was successful was that Aristide was too naive towards the coup plotters. He just saw too much good in human beings. He took down the barricades when he should have left them up, and that South Africa was sending weapons to Aristide's supporters, but they didn't get there in time. And I think that's true. They're not unfactual points, but I think that's definitely not deep enough in the analysis. I think what we can add to that is that Aristide compromised with imperialism when he came back to power, and what that did is it really demoralized his base. The things that he was elected on, he could no longer follow through if he was going to keep his end of the deal of the United States putting him back in power. And by failing to call on the mass movements, by failing to inspire them, it's not that the Haitian people didn't try to protect him and stand up, but he disoriented them with his leadership. And I think where that comes from is you look at his background, he comes from a petty bourgeois background, not from a wealthy background, but certainly not from a working class background. His liberation theology, which makes him such an inspiring person, was on a moral basis. When he says it's a mortal sin, capitalism, he's not looking at it from a scientific basis of how do you confront capitalism and destroy it. And the weakness of his base is that he really was based in the peasantry and the lumpen proletariat, the chronically unemployed in Haiti, which is not to say that there was some gigantic working class movement that he should have turned to and he turned a blind eye to, but that he didn't really move into the working class support. So what does the U.S. want with Haiti today? I think I'm starting to run a little short on time, so I'll try to go through this. Robinson, in his book, identifies that there's definitely a race vendetta. You know, those quotes from Thomas Jefferson about the United States. You know, you get the same quotes from Woodrow Wilson in the 19-teens, from Roosevelt, and so forth, of this fear of blacks in power. And what does that message send to the blacks who are oppressed in the United States? There's a fear of the revolutionary spread of ideas. I think there's also, you got to talk about Haiti as an open-air sweatshop. You have to talk about Aristide's original challenge to U.S. capital, the way that he was trying to change Haiti from a client state of the United States to an actual independent republic, taking on the comprador capitalist, much the same way that you have with Zelaya. It's about setting an example for the Caribbean, what happens if you buck U.S. hegemony. It's about the Windward Passage, the geopolitics. Haiti shares the Windward Passage with the Dominican Republic and with Cuba. And it's about regime change. The 91 Haitian regime change really laid the groundwork for this theme of humanitarian interventionism that we see in Somalia and Kosovo, which therefore led the groundwork for the humanitarian regime change in Afghanistan and Iraq. Christopher Hitchens, that bastard who, you know, the former leftist who wrote a lot of things justifying the invasion of Iraq. Wrap up. It's your choice. I won't stop talking until you make me to, so I will let you choose, but I will respect your authority. Christopher Hitchens.
Okay, I'm going to be
Christopher Hitchens, in one of his biggest editorials supporting the invasion of Iraq, said, "Look what we did in Haiti. Look how we defied the big bad coup plotters, the bad generals, the death squads. Look how we defied them. The U.S. military can be a force for progress." Completely ahistorical viewpoint, which fails to account for the fact that after the U.S. military went in and took over the headquarters of the militias that have been carrying out the deaths, they conveniently neglected to release the militias' records. which would have probably implicated the militia's contact with CIA operatives and members of the U.S. Embassy. They just took those files. If they're really a death squad, wouldn't you release that? Wouldn't there be some sort of war crimes prosecution? Right. Unless your name happened to be in their records, right? So we went in there, we stopped them, but we didn't really stop the process. The food crisis, I'll end on this example. There's a lot more to say, but the food crisis, I think, is one of the things that best illustrates what the U.S. has done to Haiti and what the United States wants out of Haiti. A lot of us remember in January reading this horrible news about Haitians eating yellow mud cake because they didn't have food. I think some of us here who read Socialist Worker remember the quote about the woman begging the foreign journalist to take one of her children, just take one, anyone you want, take them and feed them, giving up her children. This has the roots in neoliberalism. It also has the roots in the Haitian bourgeoisie. We can't let them off the hook and say this is all the United States' fault. They worked in concert. One of the wealthiest families in Haiti is called the Mev family. They bought the Haitian American Sugar Corporation, HASCO. They basically determined there was no way that HASCO could compete with CNH Sugar in the Americas based out of Hawaii, right? They said, what we're going to do is we're going to sell HASCO's equipment for scrap on the market, and instead of being the sugar producer in Haiti, we're going to be the sugar importer. So they completely flipped the script from Haiti producing all of its own sugar and selling it to the region to importing it. Originally, because the technology in the United States is more advanced and the tremendous agricultural subsidies we put into domestic corporations meant that the import of sugar was cheaper. And whatever, in the same process with all the rest of the foodstuffs, so whatever native growers there still were put out of business the way that NAFTA did to the Mexican corn growers, right? But then what it meant is that Haiti no longer has the ability to produce its own food. So when that price, that spike that hurt all of us, when we go to the liquor store now, when we go to the supermarket, when we see how expensive our food was, that spike that hurt us, in a country like Haiti, where 70 to 80% of the population survives on less than $2 a day, it made food out of their price range, and there was no local growers to turn to. So I'll stop at that. Thank you very much. I hope I made a lot of mistakes that you can come back and correct on and add to the discussion, or is there something fruitful for all of us to look at? And, yeah.
So I'm going to take a list of hands, and because I don't know everyone's names, I'm just going to call on you based on what you're wearing. I'm going to try and give people about 3 minutes per intervention, and just be conscious of that. Try not to speak forever. I will verbally give you a 30-second marker and then verbally wrap you up. And please wrap up when I tell you to wrap up. There's actually enough people in this room that I should be giving you only 2 minutes per speaker to get everyone in. So with that, I'm gonna open it up. John brought up a lot of stuff, and I'm sure people have a lot of questions. And if you have a question, also I'd like to prioritize you so people on the list can answer it. So maybe put up a finger or like a hook, just to differentiate yourself from speakers. So Plaid in front.
Okay. Ed Pitzer, L.A. Branch. A couple questions. One question is there any reason to believe that the coup that just happened in Honduras maybe had, if not backing from the Obama government, maybe some pre-backing from the Bush government, and is there any reason to believe that maybe that coup happened thinking that Obama's just starting up and they're not going to be able to, not knowing how they would react, thinking that they're not, just starting up, they're not going to be able to react one way or another, so this is a good time to do it. That's one question. Another question is, you being a high school teacher, when I was in high school, okay, I was taught a lot of nonsense, as we all have been. Mm-hmm. How much nonsense was there in teaching, and they still teach kids this, that Napoleon's reason for selling the Louisiana territory to the United States had more to do with, he had gotten the Louisiana territory when he took over Spain, which had up until just shortly had belonged to Spain, and what we were taught was that Napoleon was more interested in getting money to finance his struggle against Britain and the rest of Europe than he was in dealing with or holding on to a territory which he may in fact lose later on.
All right. There's some good questions, and you're next. And was there someone else who raised their hand besides this man over here? Okay. Go ahead.
My name is Brian from Davis. I have two questions. One of them is about more of the past, one about more of the contemporary moment. The past, with the so-called Treaty of Friendship, what compelled them to take that? Was it naivete? Was it just they needed to in order to trade, in order to survive? What were some of the factors that compelled them to take that ridiculous treaty? And the more contemporary question is, if Haiti is now more of an importer rather than a producer, and the army of labor is so poor, and in order to not be consumers, where is the surplus value coming from? How are they making capital? Like, if they can't sell it to the poor population, and they're not extracting it from them, where is the surplus value capital coming from in Haiti with regard to?
Okay.
I was just curious what, if any, if there's a connection between the election in El Salvador that just happened of Mauricio Funes, who's like far to the left, and that's the immediate neighbor directly next to Honduras, who, you know, had this leftist government and is now replaced by this more conservative type of ideology, whereas El Salvador was the flip side. Like, is there some sort of connection going on there? It's like a balance. It almost seems like, wow, it's like, wow, this great victory in El Salvador, but now suddenly, oh, Honduras is in the crapper. So, I don't know. I think there might be something there. I don't know enough about the politics of the region to know if it works state by state like that. But I thought it was really interesting.
All right, the person in the black, white tank top. Sorry.
This is slightly tangential, but regarding the Caribbean in general, as we all probably know, the United States and other imperialistic powers have a long history of strategic blockades in the Caribbean and in Latin America in general, but it's especially affected very greatly that region of the world. And I am a student of Afro-Cuban music, have been for a while, and have done some traveling based around that. And I just want to encourage, if anybody's ever thought in this room about breaking the embargo and going to Cuba and are afraid to go for whatever reason, I just want to encourage people to do it. Like, I think that one of the only ways that, or one important aspect of changing that situation and really changing the entire scope of, like, the lives of Cubans, for one thing, and, like, also just the entire landscape, really, of the Caribbean, is for people to not be afraid to stand up against that and to break it over and over and over. And I think it's actually really important that, although there is negotiation, there's talk of, you know, various things opening up, now Cuban Americans can travel to go see their family, well, you know, that's great, but it doesn't really help Cuba's economic situation. It doesn't really help them find soap and toilet paper, say, or food. So, I don't know, it's not as difficult or as daunting of a task as it seems. You may have to bribe the Mexican customs officials slightly on the way back in, but I don't know, I want to encourage people to really think about those things and think about that as even a form of activism, of just not being afraid to stand up for what you believe in, and to know that the Cubans, as a Caribbean nation, as a poor Caribbean nation, have the right to govern themselves and to make decisions for themselves, as Haiti does as well. So.
I just have a question, really. I don't know the current situation in the Dominican Republic on the other half of the island, but I wonder if a comparison of the two might shed some light on the potential that Haiti might have now or have lost. So.
Okay.
Thank you for this talk. It's incredible. Important history that is completely buried. And people think about Haiti today as a sort of just like a hopeless victim country. To actually cover that history, and I do think that, you know, I don't know as much about the situation in particular, but I do think that, you know, this movement in Honduras has everything to do with, you know, the examples of these successive governments in Latin America that have started, you know, raising more progressive policies and actually able to get away with that, especially at a time when the U.S. has bogged down in Iraq and, like, you know, especially also in countries like Venezuela that have a significant amount of natural resources that they can actually use as leverage as well. And I think the same thing goes for the Haitian Revolution being a really incredibly dangerous example, like even more so than Venezuela, right? Like, you know, actual, like, rebellion, revolution that overthrew, you know, the most powerful, you know, slave colony in the world, you know, was incredibly, you know, it was just, you know, the last, you know, hundred some years since then has been, you know, all of Israelist powers really punishing Haiti for setting that example, I think. Mm-hmm. And people should really read the Black Document. I think it's just one of the best books I've ever read. Just fabulous history. And also, you know, just goes into all the dynamics. And I can't get into that right now. But I guess I did sort of have a question, maybe along the similar lines of, like, the role of the working class in Haiti, because you said, you know, Aristide's face has been more in the poor, and it seems like, you know, to what extent do the sort of Machinadoras still exist in Haiti? What's the size and strength of the working class there? Because my feeling is that it's probably fairly weak, and that any sort of successful movement in Haiti to reverse this process is going to take massive international solidarity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another thing that's really key about
30 seconds.
Sorry, about the C.L.R. James book, but also Mark Steele's book that you mentioned, which is fabulous, is talking about how in the course of the French Revolution, you know, ordinary people in France who had nothing to do with the slave trade, probably didn't even really know about it beforehand, in a context of actually taking control of their own lives, started to read about it and find out, and were inspired by the revolution in Haiti, and actually pushed, you know, the leaders of the revolution to actually take on abolition. People organized boycotts of, you know, sugar. You know, people were saying, I refuse to take sugar in my coffee and all this, and that sort of, you know, inspiration in a time when there was no Twitter or Facebook, you know, that there's that sort of international solidarity is amazing.
Okay. I have you sitting there, and then...
Yeah, thank you. I'm Avery from San Diego, and there's an extraordinary danger with what Obama is saying about Honduras right now, and it's subtle. We need to really parse it. That's why this talk, which was really just on Haiti, is so incredibly timely, because we need to look at what happened in the 90s in Haiti to understand this danger that I'm talking about. In 91, there was a coup that overthrew Aristide, who had been elected to office with in excess of 60% of the vote, mm-hmm. after leading a mass movement, semi-revolutionary. And this coup was supported by the United States, probably the CIA. This was Bush 1. Then you mentioned Clinton's statements during the campaign, the dithering for a couple of years. 93, they went in. This is what Christopher Hitchens holds up as, oh, look, we can be a force for good, because they got rid of the coup plotters. Why did they do that? Haiti had become drastically destabilized. There was a huge refugee population. Part of it was Clinton was feeling pressure to let Haitians come into the country as refugees from a death squad government that Bush 1 had put in power and Clinton continued to support once he got in power. But the destabilization created by this and the political pressure for Haitian refugees to be allowed to come into Florida, which Clinton promised to allow but then actually denied once he was in office, meant that they recognized that the coup situation they had put in power was not working. It didn't mean they no longer feared Aristide and what he represented, though. And that's why when Clinton supported a reinvasion to actually put Aristide back in office under the terms of this bad deal that he had to agree to, or didn't have to, but he did agree to it, was one where now the U.S. military was going to be in charge of Haiti. And they could do it with a halo, because we got rid of the coup and we brought back Aristide, the beloved figure, deservedly beloved. And this was actually cheered in the streets by Haitians, by the supporters of Aristide, because he's coming back. And wait, the United States is saving us. Within a couple of years, it became evident there was total disillusionment with that, because it was clear that this was not getting rid of the death squads, and it was maintaining the insane level of inequality within Haiti, and that those troops were being used to repress Haitians themselves. So when we hear that the Organization of American States takes the position that says Zelaya must be immediately reinstated in power, and then Obama, who initially, he and Clinton sort of take a neutral position on the coup, not even opposed to the coup, but then they're pulled into making statements more like, well, we're against the coup and there needs to be a restoration of democracy, but not saying, why aren't they saying...
30 seconds.
Okay. Why aren't they saying Zelaya must be immediately reinstated in power?
Right.
I mean, the OAS has said that, and they've even said, well, whatever the OAS says. But the point is, they are sending signals, because they're not letting the words come out directly, to allow them to have an intervention in Honduras. Maybe they will bring back Zelaya, I mean, this is all still unfolding, right? And I don't even know a whole lot of the details. But they see an opening with this coup, and I don't know how much they back this coup. I have no idea about that. It's possible that they did. But now the possibility of a change of regime, which can give them a greater foothold in the country, is something they have clearly in mind.
Okay. And then I have you over here.
Albert from Peace and Freedom Party. I agree that the Toussaint Louverture Revolution is one of the most inspiring events in recent history. One thing that inspires me a lot is that there was apparently a Muslim contingent in Napoleon's army which deserted and joined the forces of the I think it's clear that Obama's job description is simply to provide words and what goes on underneath. Well, we have to keep in mind, he's now the leading enemy of mankind as leading imperialist, period. And we'll start from there. Of course, you mentioned humanitarian revolutions, and Kosovo and the rest of it, all the different modes that imperialism is having of doing its thing. But in particular, I would think that one would want to put into perspective the so-called color revolutions, rose and what have you, that what's going on, I would think, would be another mode, and what's going on with Celaya, yet another sneakier version. But I guess that brings me to my question about your posing this Twitter attack on the ruling class in Iran. I guess it's hard for me to see the Iran situation other than in the context of these colored revolutions, and that what's going on has very much the character of a mobilization of COINTEL forces, as we know of them, some updated version. But withal, how in the world can an independent workers' movement find its voice in Iran now? How can we speak to it and get a hearing that wouldn't simply put us with the forces we detest, the CIA? And it seems to me that you have to speak on the basis of internationalism. You have to speak as an organization which is international and building a section in Iran independent of the Mousavi ruling class element as well as of the Ahmadinejad.
Okay. We have the woman in the brown back here.
Thanks. I was going to ask a question that Evie sort of answered for me, so now I actually visited Haiti, and I was going to give a couple of sort of like folk parables that are kind of fun. One of the two revolutionaries that John mentioned was Dessalines, and the Haitians are still today very, very proud that they were the first black republic in the country, in the world, in 1804, and they remember that date very solidly. And there's a parable told about Dessalines, which I like a lot, which is that there's two men went to a cemetery to ask the gravekeeper to bring them the head of Dessalines. And he said, okay. When he returned, the skull that he brought them seemed to be the head of a small child. And they told him, well, this can't be the head of Dessalines. This is clearly the size of a boy's head. And they said, well, this is Dessalines when he was young. And I feel like the message is that it's a very revolutionary, to me, a very revolutionary parable, which is that Dessalines is just a man, and we are all just men, and we all have the same. In other words, to not make a hero of Dessalines, but that that struggle is universal, and that we all have the capability of being revolutionaries. Just kind of hope that I wanted to tell that story. And to speak about the misery in Haiti. It's absolutely right that they really, I never saw a working class when I was there. What I saw was just utter, like, bleak poverty. There was a project in Haiti called Cité Soleil, which is City of the Sun. Sounds very optimistic, but it's actually the imagery, and then I'm going to recommend a movie at the end of this, but basically people's homes in this area consist of four pieces of material, which is four bed sheets and four posts. you put four posts up and you hang bed sheets from each side, and that's your square of land on a pile of dirt. And dirt is actually a really, like, it would be better if it were dirt, but it's actually piles of trash, rotting banana peels. These people are literally picking their food. They are sharing food with flies and dogs. It's not an exaggeration. It's disgusting. And the final thing is there's a film called The Agronomist, and there was a radio host who was eventually assassinated. Yeah, he was eventually assassinated, but he supported Al-Isti while Al-Isti was coming into power. And then when Al-Isti was expelled, obviously talked a lot about on the radio the ridiculousness of that. And then when but even before then, what became critical of Al-Isti when Al-Isti began to sort of apologize a little bit and sort of cooperate more with the corrupt capitalists. And the sort of biography of this man called the agronomist. Because he was an agronomist. And so the working class in Haiti is actually an agrarian working class. And anyway, it's sort of enlightening on some of the history.
Okay. Oh, what's the movie?
Oh, it's called The Agronomist.
Oh, okay. The Agronomist, sorry. Okay, I'm going to hand it back to John to answer some questions for a little bit, and also to get more people on the stack, because there's only three people and we've got about a half an hour left. And so I'm going to let him... Yeah, answer some of the questions.
I promise to confuse the situation more, so there'll be more opportunity. So what I should say is, as it was confusing, I wasn't clear about the role of where capital and profit comes from in Haiti, so thank you for bringing that up. Haiti is an importer of foodstuffs, the kind of basic things you need to sustain your life. Haiti is an exporter of sweatshop labor, so that's where the Haitian elite gets their money from, right? The things you can't eat or survive in, whether it's clothing, stuff like that. Basically, what we associate with the maquilas, that's the same thing there. So they import their food, which makes them incredibly dependent on other countries, the international markets. But then they export the labor of the sweatshop labor, what would pass for the Haitian working class, keeping in mind how their economy hasn't been allowed to actually develop in a way that could have a majority working class. And it's really even crueler than export crops. It's an even crueler situation. They have to bring in their food and sell their labor. I believe the optimistic estimates of a sweatshop labor in Haiti is $7 a day, but I think that's incredibly optimistic. We know from a lot of the USAS campaigns against sweatshops that they get paid far less. So talking about the Haitian movement, probably the biggest impediment right now to popular organizing in Haiti is the United Nations occupation, which is absolutely criminal. And I think our movement as an anti-imperialist movement, or what should be an anti-imperialist movement, is much better at criticizing countries that the U.S. Army takes over, and not very good at criticizing situations when the U.N. Army takes over. So if I can talk about that for a second. United Nations troops have occupied Haiti since 2004. There are currently nearly 10,000 military, police, and civilian administrators led by Brazil, which is seeking a larger role as a regional leader. The annual budget of the UN occupation is $600 million, double the annual national budget of the Haitian government.
Oh my God.
One of the things that the UN troops have been doing is conducting raids into the slums around Port-au-Prince on the pretext of stopping gangs. Massive human rights violations, massacres have occurred. If you go to the SF Bayview website, they have a video posted which definitively shows UN peacekeepers driving into what seems like a relatively peaceful rally and firing warning shots at them at head level and then driving away. Tens of thousands of people have protested against the UN occupation last December, something that wasn't really covered hardly even in the alternative press, to be honest with you, hardly covered at all. And the criminal role, the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, took a trip to Haiti last month with President Clinton, who he named as a special envoy to Haiti for the UN. And the crux of their platform for rebuilding Haiti is that, one, let's reduce the port fees, which is something the French demanded when they last tried to take over the country, and two, expand the export zone, because sweatshop workers in the export zone are going to be vaulted into the Haitian middle class by making $7 a day. Like, that's the UN, literally, how they're going to rebuild Haiti is on neoliberalism.
Okay, I have one in the... No, not you. The woman in front of you.
I'm glad you mentioned the the issue of the anti-war movement and UN troops, because I think we have to look at, you know, what's happening in Honduras, what's been happening in Haiti, what's been happening in Iran, I think is incredibly relevant to this discussion in regards to, U.S. intervention and destabilization of miscellaneous regimes around the world, because I do think, I'm not as up on the details of kind of our support to kind of forces in Honduras, and it would actually kind of be a question. I know I've read like some things about us giving money and training to like militia forces and like counter or forces that are against kind of the Zelaya government in Honduras. But we have, you know, spent millions upon millions of dollars to destabilize Iran. And we have, I know, spent a lot of money in a lot of other places to destabilize regimes in a way that is, it's very covert for people that live here in the United States, because we don't really see that money kind of going to places, and we don't overtly see, troops kind of installed. And so the myths of, you know, U.S. intervention as a good thing and this destabilization that we're doing around the world and the necessity for us to be taking up, you know, U.S. hands off of wherever it may be at this point, because there's so many kajillions of places that we're involved in. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a question there about if people have more details about the U.S.'s relationship to Honduras. And then I also wanted to ask a question about response here in the United States. I know that there's been, you know, on the Iran question, there have been like some demonstrations and things like that in support of, the folks that are out in the streets demonstrating. And just as I was walking over here from getting coffee earlier, I actually saw a number of cars driving by mm-hmm. with Honduran flags and Zelaya signs out. So I don't know if folks have, if there's like examples, if people see things happening around, or if there are things that I think we should be supporting, the 10,000 people that came out, which I hadn't read about, and marched in support of Zelaya in Honduras. So if there's any information about that, I'd appreciate hearing it.
All right, Red Kofi in the back, followed by the SF gray hat.
My name is David. I'm from San Francisco. I think we got to step back a little bit, because if we look at what's happening in the world today, we got the biggest economic crisis that we've seen since the Great Depression. The reason that they were eating mud cakes in Haiti is because of this part of the economic crisis. That's the result there. It's putting tremendous pressure on governments all over the world. I don't know, I can't say exactly how that's happening, but if you just look at California, we're issuing IOUs to institutions and paying people in IOUs, the state of California. The last time that happened, the Depression, okay? That's huge pressure on these governments around the world. I think that's what's behind what's going on in Honduras right now, is that there's pressures that they didn't have to deal with before, and all around the Latin America and there you have left-wing governments, and they're afraid that that's what they're going to, a section of Honduras is afraid that that's what's going to happen. I think the same is true in Iran. There's tremendous economic pressures on the people of Iran. There's like 40% unemployment for women that are aged 20 to 40 or something like that in Iran, and for men it's 20%. These pressures are going to put rebellions happen. We cannot say that we are with Ahmadinejad when he steals an election and then goes around and unleashes right-wing forces to go in and smash popular rebellions.
That's right.
The popular rebellion got millions of people on the street to beat back the police and beat back the Baji. That is not the effort of the United States that's behind that. Of course, we have to say that the U.S. is going to try to intervene in these places to get what they want. So we got to say, hands off Iran, hands off Honduras. That should be the message that we bring to the movement and really stand with the people that are in rebellion in these countries.
Okay, after the gray hat, I have the black shirt in the back again, if you still want to get on. And then I actually have an open... Oh, no, I have Steve after that. And then I have an open list, so I encourage people to bring up questions. There are still some questions on the floor about the Treaty of Friendship. Was that naive? I don't think anyone has addressed that, unless I didn't hear it. And then also, I think the question of where is surplus value coming from, John answered that pretty well. So, take you.
All right. My name is Miguel. I'm from Oakland City. I think in addition to seeing what's happening in Honduras as a continuation of American imperialist policy, of seeing Latin America as America's backyard. I think you should see what's going on today as like a vision of what could be happening in the future as far as the left-wing governments coming up, not only in South America, but Central America. You have Chavez in Venezuela, you have Evo Morales in Bolivia, both of them who were elected. Not only that, you have former guerrilla groups turned political parties, such as the FMLN in El Salvador, the FSLN in Nicaragua, were, again, elected. And I think the bodies being elected are much more dangerous than them coming into power through guerrilla means, because it shows that they were elected by the people and are legitimate. They're legitimate governments. If we don't stand up against what our government is doing in Honduras, we could see a rollback in all these countries. We could see, at best, you know, we'll see these governments going back to the right. And at worst, we'll see a regression back to the times where there were death squads, people being disappeared, stuff like Operation Condor, if any of you guys know what that is, which is a cooperation of right-wing military governments who work with each other to disappear people all over the continent. You could see us going back to that era. So I think if we don't take a stand against what's going on right now, we could see this happening more time and time and again.
Okay, you in the back.
Okay, thank you. As far as what should we say if there's a government that's not in the U.S. camp and there's a movement for justice against that, generally, the U.S. government, if it's possible, will try to form a relationship and co-opt, say, like something like the movement in Iran. Maybe you'd see something similar with the potential for an intervention in Honduras based around bringing Zelaya back, which is a very speculative thing to even talk about at this point. I mean, someone said we have to say hands off these countries, and we also, to the extent possible that we can communicate this, have to say to the people in those countries that watch out for co-optation. It's a trap. You shouldn't, you know, and that there's an alternative to support from outside powers or the U.S. power. The alternative is what happened in Venezuela, which John laid out, that Chavez was overthrown and there was a massive uprising that physically stopped through revolutionary means the coup there at that time. Hopefully that's still not off the table in Honduras. It's not clear yet. It seems like that's open and there's signs that could be developing. Let's hope that it is. And I think that helps us understand a little bit too about some of the meaning of the FMLN victory in El Salvador recently and FSLN a couple years ago with Ortega in Nicaragua. That really the FMLN candidate, one of the Funes, was on the basis of a sharp move to the right by this historically left-wing party. And it reminds me of the original platform of Chavez and what Chavez's government meant for the first couple years that it was in power, because it did, in practice, not very much. Until it was overthrown, which then was the basis for this mass mobilization semi-revolution that put Chavez back in power. That's what opened up the political space and changed the balance of class forces in the country so that more substantial reforms could be introduced and had to be introduced. I don't think we'll see. Now, of course, that's changed the balance of forces across the continent and the expectations across the continent to some degree. I think that's paved the way for more elections like the ones that we've talked about. But they face similar dynamics. I think as far as Honduras, that's the alternative there today is what's already happened in Venezuela.
All right. I have one speaker on the list, and then we have 20 minutes more for discussion. So I highly encourage
early lunch.
Right. Sure. All right.
Yeah, my name is Steve. I'm from Seattle. I just wanted to bring up the whole question of the politics of the movement for restoration of Zelaya in Honduras. I don't know if it's happened in other places around the country or not, but in Seattle there was a demonstration called, I think Monday night, against the coup, and one of the main demands was not just that Zelaya come back, but that the U.S. intervene to put him back. And I think it's something that we have to make a really sharp argument against on the basis of, you know, what people said before about what happened in Haiti. In 1993, it looked, superficially, it looked like the U.S. was on the side of the angels. Here was Aristide, been elected, thrown out, and now we're going to go in and get rid of these military plotters and put Aristide back in. Who could be against that? And yet, what happened as a result of it is has been explained, the imposition of neoliberalism. So we have to be really clear in the movement that it's a very different thing having our solidarity with the people in Honduras and other places versus calling on the U.S. government to do that.
Right.
But I also think it's very interesting that Obama is not being more clear. It seems like it would be in his advantage to say totally that he's against the coup. I mean, that would make sense from his viewpoint, but he's not doing that. And I'm quite clear about that. And this one thing real quick on Brazil being the dominant force in Haiti right now shows the very limitations of the left-wing governments in Latin America and the need to continue to fight even after those governments get in, that Lula was seen as a real left-wing agent and then has accommodated the neoliberalism and the reinforcement of UN imperialism.
Right.
Okay, June the Brown, and then an open list.
I think it was Ashley that mentioned that she saw some people that there seemed to be some kind of hunger and solidarity thing happening in San Francisco today. I heard last night late that, and I didn't plan, I think that anybody here would plan on going because we're all at this conference, but there was a call at 12 o'clock to protest in front of the Honduran consulate. And I believe that might be a nationwide call because I know that there was supposed to be something in front of the LA Honduran consulate as well, but I don't know if that was on the same day. And about that, someone mentioned, I think it was John mentioned, that this sort of excuse of that the military forces or the UN forces are beating down gangs in Haiti. Again, I was in Haiti, and there are absolutely no gangs. The only gangs are the besieged, like, state police, these thugs. And I saw them when I was in Haiti, and they were really scary. It's these guys riding around in trucks with, automatic, the things with the whole strings of bullets or whatever, and they're like, at one point we were driving to a concert in the countryside, and they were right in front of us. There's like these eight guys with masses of guns and looking at us straight in the eye like, you guys do anything we don't like, we could just completely annihilate you right here, right now. So really scary stuff, but there's no street gangs. There are a lot of protests, and they are peaceful protests. There's this constant rioting in Haiti, and it's so desperate because the repression is so, so bad. But they'll just, they'll block. They're so desperate that they'll just cut off electrical lines because they don't know what else to do, or they'll, and this is like a daily thing, when I was there for just a few weeks, at least four times, one of the intersections that we were close to had burning tires in the middle of the intersection to block the intersection, to block traffic. It's just like this total desperation to just kind of this cry for, but yeah, I liked what somebody said earlier about the need for solidarity, international solidarity with both Haiti and Honduras, because, there isn't, I don't think that there's any hope for it, sort of like a, I don't know, it's just really a desperate situation.
All right, I'm going to hand it back to John because there's no one on the list, and then I'll watch for last round of hands, basically.
I mean, I guess I'll just say this. I think the most dangerous gang members in Haiti right now are the ones wearing blue helmets. They're the ones wearing business suits. They're the ones who come from the U.S. Aid Department, and they're the people who are members of the group of 184, which is the business class association.
Right.
And it's not because those people are physically going into the streets and killing more people than anyone else. It's because they're enabling the situation that I do actually think there's a sprawling gang problem in Haiti. I would be surprised if there wasn't, given the poverty and misery and utter destruction of this country, this once most gorgeous gem of a nation before it was despoiled by the West. But they're the ones who enabled the situation. And I don't think that I've said anything today that all of you don't already know more or less this information. But the challenge is for us to get out there and get this information out, because there is a counter-narrative. Surprise, surprise, one of the biggest people who's pushing this narrative that the UN occupation is justified is someone who I formerly deeply admired, Wyclef Jean, the Haitian-American musician, actually executive produced a film called Ghost of Cité Soleil, which is a propaganda film demonizing Aristide and his supporters as thugs and gang members. It's been referred to as Lenny Riefenstahl Goes to the Caribbean. Literally, it is such a tactless film that they translate the bloodthirsty chants, and then when the chants turn to like restoring democracy, bringing Aristide back, or peace, they just don't translate them so that an American audience that doesn't speak French or Creole doesn't know what the protesters are saying. Goes and finds gang members who are paid by the producers of the film to talk about how they're actually paid by Aristide. I mean, the most like blatant, like Fox News would blush, right? And the thing that's so dangerous is that if Fox News put this out, we'd all know it was a load of shit, and we would probably show it to people and be like, look, if Fox News says this, you know the opposite is true, solidarity. Right. Why could... Clef spoke alongside Howard Zinn at Voices of a People's History in D.C. in January. He's down with Howard Zinn. And he put out a propaganda film, which I think puts a lot of people on the left in kind of a bind. You know, you got to really start searching through. You got to really be a committed anti-imperialist. Understand the predatory nature of U.S. foreign policy in each and every situation. Because otherwise, why wouldn't you believe Clef? He's Haitian American. His raps are about the struggle of refugees, the discrimination, the heartbreak. If he's going to come out as a Haitian American who's down with Howard Zinn and say this, that puts you in a bind, and you got to really be sharp. I don't think there's anything I could say that you don't know, but I'll say it anyway, not just to hear my own voice. But you go back to the history, right? In 1954, the CIA organized the overthrow of the president of Guatemala. 1960, they deposed Patrice Lumumba and have him executed, the first prime minister of the Congo after independence. During the Vietnam War, you have Operation Phoenix, where they tortured tens of thousands of Vietnamese in order to get actionable intelligence, right? Abu Ghraib. You've got, in 1968, the CIA organized a military coup that brought Saddam Hussein to power. The 1980s, the covert war against the Sandinistas. Like I said earlier, CIA operatives trained the Honduran military death squad unit known as Battalion 316. We've been talking a lot about torture in Iraq and the, you know, the FBI and the CIA, and the CIA would do extraordinary renditions. What do you think they did in 1984? They taught them how to torture and they walked out of the room. What do you think is going to happen? You teach someone how to do something and you close the door. What else are they going to do, right? But that's how they got that plausible deniability. And I think that our position, which sounds like a position that everyone has expressed, is that Haiti absolutely demands and deserves our solidarity, meaning ending the UN occupation, returning the rightfully elected president. Whatever weaknesses he has, he was elected by the people, and they have the right to determine who leads their country. And we really need a Marshall Plan type series of reparations that can only begin to touch on the wealth that has been extracted from Haiti to the benefit of Western imperialism for the past 200 years. The question is, how do you do that? How do you go beyond denouncing imperialism? How do you actually make a difference? And I think that something we bring uniquely to the table as the Socialism Conference is that when we talk about solidarity with the Haitian people as part of a broader movement of solidarity with Afghanistan, Iraq, and Palestine, what we're ultimately talking about is not that these protests don't matter and that we shouldn't go to them and do that and raise it. We're talking about the power of the working class. The thing that can actually stop imperialism, the thing that, if you look at it, perhaps with the exception of France, I don't think there's any country in the world that bears more responsibility for the situation in Haiti and Honduras than the United States. And our solidarity with the Haitian people isn't just out of guilt. Like, God, I live in a fucked up country. I'm going to do this. It's because we live in the primary responsible country. We live in the belly of the beast. The centrality of where we're at now is that what we do actually can make a difference. In theory, the possibilities, not to say that it's happening, but what we do can make a difference. When we talk about speaking truth to power, right, we're talking about being the voice that is Amy Goodman, being the voice that is Counterpunch, being the voice that is Socialist Worker, the SF Bayview, Rose Aguilar. That's very important, but we have to make a difference. And I think where we make that difference is you talk about things like when the ILWU shut down the port in solidarity with Mumia, when they shut down the ports against the Iraq War. That's the power of the working class. We talk about political strikes, strikes that aren't just about getting a raise or fighting for your health care, but strikes that are saying something. That's what we have to get to. And I think we're a very long ways away from it, but the fact that we have socialism conferences in Chicago with 1,000 people, in here in San Francisco with 700 people, and last year it was just 1,000 people combined, that there's something in the air. Something in the air that we're beginning to make some inroads, that we're beginning to redevelop those networks, that when we talk about what they had in the 60s, what they had in the 30s, we're starting to do a little bit of that in a small way, which potentially gives us that access to the power of the working class. So that we don't have to rely on, like, is it more, you know, to Obama's favor to support this or oppose it? But we can actually say, who the fuck cares what it matters to him? We're going to do what it matters to the international working class. We're going to get up there. We're going to get organized. So I'll just end by saying that if you guys haven't joined the ISO already, or you haven't brought up the issue of Haiti with the groups you do belong to, I think you know what you got to do. So thank you very much.